Hello, listeners. Just Ben flying solo this week. Barry is currently convalescing at home, both dealing with the physical ailment of a cold and the emotional ailment of the Irish rugby team hilariously losing to the Japanese rugby team. So if you want to make him feel better, what you can do is hop on board and become a Patreon supporter of this podcast. It is the lifeblood of this podcast. It means that myself and Barry can spend the time that we do researching and putting the podcast together, investing in some new equipment, which we are doing right now, both for this podcast and a new one that I'm going to be launching in the new year. I've got a sexy recorder and some sexy new microphones on the way to us. And also so we can do new and exciting things. We've put some new goals on our Patreon site, where when we hit certain targets, we will put on a live show featuring special guests from previous episodes. We will put on a dinner party based on the Futurists cookbook, where four of you will be invited along to sample the frankly bizarre and unsanitary recipes available there, and we will put on a special Worst Foot Forward pub quiz episode that you can play along with at home and feature some of the weirdest trivia we've discovered. All that is available if you hop on board and support us. Doesn't have to be much. Like, if you've enjoyed this, if you've listened to 10, 20, 30, 40 episodes, just chuck us a couple of dollars a month. That's, you know, that's pence or cents an episode, but it helps keep us going. If you feel like giving us a wee bit more, $3 a month, you get some extra special bonus material. $5 a month, you can suggest a topic for us to talk about. $10 a month, you can judge a show. $20 a month, you can guest on a show. The only other thing I wanted to tell you about this week is I'm taking my solo show, Fable Maker, on tour in the next few weeks. If you live in London, then on October the 10th, it is at my own club, Good Ship Comedy in Camden Town. If you live in the Midlands, then it's on at the Funny Things Festival at the Lichgate Tavern in Wolverhampton on October the 27th. And then if you live in the other bit of the Midlands, it's on at the Nottingham Comedy Festival on November the 3rd. And I think the Chameleon Cafe, it is called. It'd be lovely to see you there. It was cracking to meet a few listeners at the Ember Fringe, and it'd be cracking to meet a few more of you and make you laugh in person rather than over the airwaves. That's not really how podcasts work. Via Wi-Fi or broadband or dial-up, you know, if you're old school. Anyway, that's all of the admin, all of the advertising. If you have listened to this bit and haven't, you know, skipped through it, do us a wee little favour. And please send Barry the most heartfelt commiserations and condolences you possibly can for the death of Irish rugby. RIP, guys. RIP. And that will obviously be a lovely gift that he will treasure, which fits perfectly with this week's topic. It's the world's worst gift, with the excellent Rachel Wheely. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. They say that yesterday is history, tomorrow is a mystery, but today is a gift. That's why they call it the present. And that's also why you're probably staring at today, wondering who the hell thought you'd want a gift of a resurgence of Nazism, the dissolution of the most successful customs union in the world, and the inevitable heat death of the planet, when you'd have been perfectly happy with just a book token. And alongside me is the batteries not included to my re-gifted selection box of dildos, it's Ben Vandeveld.
My good lord.
Are the batteries also not included in the passed on dildos?
Yeah, very much so. They've been worn down.
Oh my god, that's what I love. So, you know the riddle about what gets shorter the more it's used, or... Now, what's the riddle where the answer is either a pencil or a candle?
What's tall when it's young and short when it's old?
Yeah, the terrifying answer is a dildo. Just one that's just been ground down to a little dildo nubbin. Dildo Nubbin, of course, was a recording artist from the Caribbean.
No, I thought it was a rejected hobbit name.
Yeah, we can wrap up. We're done.
The Nubbins of Nubend.
Oh, that's brilliantly horrible.
I think we found your drag name as well.
Dildo Nubbin. That's astonishing. I mean, I'm guessing that's a tiny little dildo with lots of hair on the end of it.
Oh, that's very sad.
Yeah, or you could have a before and after. You'd have kind of like the Schmeagle dildo and the Gollum dildo.
Are you pitching your new range?
Yeah!
Okay, fine. Go to Ben's GoFundMe page.
Yeah. Yeah, it's various things to enter Mount Doom.
Come on, Ben, just the one ring.
We're meant to be quite
a serious trivia podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had academics on this show, Barry. We've had someone who delivered the Royal Institution lecture.
We've had an MP on this show.
We've been to the Houses of Parliament.
But please buy our short chody dildos. That's going to be our first line of merch.
What a worst foot forward dildo.
What? Broken the podcast.
Yeah. What are the settings that would be on the worst foot forward dildo?
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, uncomfortable. Then it would just turn into a TENS machine.
Yeah.
Right, I'm going to attempt to bring some semblance of...
Sorry,
Rich. I can't add to this because I haven't been introduced yet.
I know, the worst is when we have these conversations that there is someone just sitting there looking at us going, what are you two fucking idiots talking about?
Well, let's introduce the person who is thinking, yeah. What are you two fucking idiots talking about? She was raised at Eton College. Don't laugh at that.
It is true.
It is true. We're going to find out more about that in a minute. Where a school she was not allowed to attend on account of, I imagine, both not being a boy and not being rich enough. But I might be wrong on at least one, if not two, of those things. She's experienced life at the finest of educational establishments, and I presume living inside a broom cupboard there, like some sort of public school Harry Potter. After a decade of cream teas, croquet and boating adventures, she moved to suburban London and now reflects on what she learned in her upbringing. She now works as a writer, producer, performer and science communicator, having been heard on BBC Radio 4 Extra, as well as having her material aired on News Track, The News Quiz and Listen Against. She is also the producer of the wonderful Level Up podcast, whose host Simon Watt has appeared on this show before. And most magnificently of all, she is the brains behind Towel Day, an annual celebration of the galactic genius of Douglas Adams. We're delightful to welcome the fun-size, peer-reviewed, fully gift-wrapped Rachel Wheely.
Hi.
Hi.
There is so much to, I apologise, the gift-wrap thing, unpack in that introduction.
Yeah.
Do you know where your towel is?
I always know where my towel is. Yeah. I have one in my bag.
Okay, great.
I carry them with me all the time, just in case.
You seem like a pretty groovy frood.
I am, thanks. I'm the grooviest. It's hoopy, actually.
Is it hoopy fruit?
Yeah,
hoopiest fruit in the universe.
Another rejected Harvard name there.
Yeah.
Eaton?
Yes.
Were you a daughter of a staff member?
That's
or was that
correct,
that?
Okay, yep. My fine. Dad taught there for 20 years, and so I grew up in the same school year as Prince William at a school I was not allowed to attend. It was like being raised in the 18th century.
Wow.
In my mind, you're like Lyra in the Northern Lights and His Dark Materials. Mm-hmm. You read that?
I have, yeah. I'm not seeing how exactly it's like that.
Well, no, the polar bear you brought with you. Yeah.
I just have a little rabbit that lives on my shelf.
Yeah, well, no, because she grew up in Oxford and her father is like a lecturer in the university there.
Oh.
And she's sort of like nipping in between all the colleges and up on the awnings, but she's not allowed to take part in any of the academia. So
yeah.
That's what I imagine young
Rachel's
exactly
like. That's
exactly
right. I just went round using all the extremely expensive facilities and
tremendous.
Going up and down on the boating lake and sneaking into boys' windows. No, not that one. Basically, it was just a very strange experience where it was me and 1,000 adolescent aristocrats. And so I had no friends, and so I was raised by Radio 4.
We always ask our guest, Rachel, what they're worst at in the world. What are you worst at?
I'm really, really bad at filtering out background music. Because I was raised by Radio 4 in Eton College, I then got completely obsessed with radio, ended up working in radio. But the practical upshot of this is that I can't actually listen to Muzak in stores at all. It's horrendous because I focus on it too much. You know, like, have you ever been into an M&S?
Yes.
Like, into the clothing range, and you get this, like... Basically, it starts off with the Lighthouse Family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, and then they'll hit you with Greatest Day by Take That. And then it'll be Katie Tunstall, and then it'll be Gabrielle. And by the time you've listened to all of those four things, you're just weeping into the cashmere. It's absolutely horrendous. Yeah. And I cannot filter it out. It just really affects me too much.
I think, you know what, they do that, and they lead you on a journey. They start with Take That's Greatest Day. And they make the way to Daniel Powter's Bad Day by the end of it. So you've gone from half an hour mooching around M&S to feeling really shit about the world around you.
Well, I looked this up, right? And apparently M&S don't have music anymore because there was an actual campaign by a man called Nigel Rogers, which is like the most social activist name ever. And his company was called Pipe Down. And he was trying to get like piped music removed from all stores, and he actually succeeded in getting M&S to can all the music, so there isn't any anymore. But it used to be the worst.
Yeah, because we have this weird relationship with music at the moment, because the like medieval and sort of Middle Ages London, there was music everywhere. People were playing music in the street, and there were singers and criers and all sorts of stuff. And now we've sort of like privatized, and music was more public, and we've privatized music with earphones and so on.
But if you go into shops, it's still really, really prevalent. Yeah. And they do it deliberately. Like, they'll play music that's better than the music downstairs if they want you to go upstairs. If they play classical music, they sell more wine.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
There's all this dark art that goes on, like, when they're choosing what music to play in shops. And I think I'm just too empathetic. I just, like... I get really sucked in to hearing Broken Wings by Mr. Mister. I just can't help myself but fill up a massive trolley with chocolate.
How are you with Muzak in lifts?
Well, lift isn't so bad because you're not in them for very long, so that's all right. But
and also,
when
I think an awkward silence lift is not a happy place.
No, I think lift is okay, actually. When I used to work at the BBC, we would get in a lift and they would play Radio 1 Extra in the lift. So you'd just get, like... You'd be walking along with your headphones in, listening to whatever you wanted to listen to. Then you'd have 27 seconds of grime. And then you'd get out. It was very surreal.
Yeah.
But then the different lifts had different radio stations playing in them. So I would deliberately head round to the Radio 3 lift for a glass of Merlot on the way up to the second floor.
So, this week we are talking about the world's worst gift, and Ben is going to be the first to reach into his stocking.
A word which, by the way, so stocking, as I grew up in a Jewish household, I never had a stocking until I was 23.
Oh, yeah.
And I keep forgetting the name for it and will often refer to it as a Christmas sock. but the first... thing I looked at was white elephants.
Oh, cool.
Because the term a white elephant famously means like an unwanted gift or something that someone has been burdened with that they cannot get rid of. Now, white elephants were originally seen as being sacred creatures, sort of like a red heifer in Judaic lore. Mm. And also... Oh, there's another white thing that's seen as being sacred. I think
it's supremacy.
Yeah. No, I think it's what it's. Isn't it white cows in India?
I think cows in general. It might be.
No, I know that cows in general, but I thought that white cows are specifically. But anyway, various South Asian monarchs in Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, to possess one was regarded as showing that you had an enormous amount of power and wealth, and it would bless the kingdom with peace and prosperity, and their titles would often reflect that they had white elephants. So, for example, the third monarch of the Kongbang dynasty, a chap called Hsin Byushin, literally that meant the Lord of the White Elephant. And because these animals were considered sacred, they would be protected by law from carrying out any sort of labour. However, gifting them was often seen as both a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing because they were being given a sacred animal.
Mm-hmm.
It was a curse because they were basically being given a very expensive to maintain animal that had no practical use.
White privilege.
Yeah, exactly. The term white elephant, meaning sort of this expensive burden, was first used in the early 17th century, but became more widespread in the 19th century. One source suggests it was popularised by P.T. Barnum, because he was gifted a white elephant called Tun Talong, who he billed as the sacred white elephant of Burma, which he had acquired from the King of Siam. But he discovered that the white elephant was actually a dirty grey one covered in pink spots. He bought it from the same guy who painted the racehorse that you talked about in last week's episode.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love all that sort of background.
That's great.
On that. The first awful gift that I'm going to look at was a gift that was given by Alfred Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock, famous director of Psycho and the Birds. He gifted something horrifying to Tippi Hedren's daughter. Now, Tippi Hedren was the star of The Birds, and Alfred Hitchcock unleashed live birds on her during the movie.
Yeah, I'm already feeling awkward about this.
A gift to Melanie Griffith, who was Hedren's six-year-old daughter, Hitchcock gave her a wax figurine of her mother in a coffin dressed in the same costume that she wore in The Birds.
Wow.
So, under the pretense of promoting the film, he actually had her come into the studios to make a face mask of her. He then gave that face mask to his special effects guy, who shrunk it down, turned it into this doll that he put inside a coffin and gave to Melanie Griffith.
Had Melanie given any indication that this was the sort of gift she'd be interested in?
No, not at all.
Wow. I'm confused as to the point of this. Why did he give her a doll of her mother in a coffin?
I think it's because he's Alfred Hitchcock and he's a really weird man.
Yeah.
Melanie Griffith, when asked about it, simply replied, "He was a motherfucker, and you can quote me on that."
And we have.
Did she even have... I'm trying to decide if it would have been better or worse if the wax figure had like a wick in the top and it was actually a candle that she could melt her own mother as well. I don't know if that's an improvement or not.
That's crafting.
Okay.
That's totally fine.
Yeah, that's
very... And the coffin is just a convenient storage box.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what coffins are generally, aren't they? They're just for human storage. I found some other eldritch and sinister suggestions. I reckon you might have gone to this place as well, but I looked at a lot of diplomatic gifts and presidential gifts.
Yeah.
But a really creepy one was several presidents received gifts from a chap called Seth Kinman, who was an early Californian settler and a professional hunter. And Seth Kinman went to the Rasputin school of hair and sartorial style. And what he would do, he would kill an animal and then use its bones and its skin to create a presidential chair.
Wow. So, oh yeah, I've seen some of these.
Yeah, they're incredible. So every time that the president was elected, he would build him what he called a savage throne. The first one that I found was Rutherford B. Hayes. He killed a bear and used its bones and its feet to create this really creepy bear chair.
That's really, really terrifying.
Imagine they'd gone with that instead of like the Resolute desk.
Yeah.
Well, that with the Resolute desk. Very nice.
Trump would love that shit.
Oh, God, so much. He also made one for Andrew Johnson. There's another one that he made out of elk horns, which sort of is like
uncomfortable to sit on.
Really uncomfortable to sit. Apparently, that was made for Abe Lincoln, who said that he would rather eat his elk horn chair, antlers and all, than sit in it. So the elk horn chair is now on display in the Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Center in Ohio. But they are some of the most disgusting and uncomfortable looking chairs you've ever seen in your life.
I do love that all, like, basically the protocol with presidential gifts is they're not allowed to keep the gifts, so they give them to like a protocol unit in the State Department, and then when they go on to the National Archives, and then they sort of log it and value it and so on and store it, and then when the president retires and they set up the presidential library or the presidential center, whatever it is, a few things probably get stored in there. So you have, like, I think Reagan's presidential library has a portrait of him in jelly beans.
Yes! I imagine, like, those presidential storage, it's sort of like the bric-a-brac version of the warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
Like, somewhere in there, there is actually the Ark of the Covenant, but made out of macaroni.
Yeah. Apparently, federal employees in the United States can't accept gifts valued over $390.
There's a similar rule in the UK,
yeah.
Which is that if the Queen is given something, she's allowed to give it to charity or to staff if it is valued at less than £150.
Yeah.
And if it's over £150, she doesn't technically own it.
Oh,
it goes into the royal collection, yeah. Like in America. But I think she's probably quite pleased about that.
Yeah, to be fair, it's the number of weird gifts she's been given.
I mean, one of them was an actual elephant.
Yes.
which was given to her by Cameroon in 1972. And had to go to London Zoo.
Thanks, Cameroon.
Oh, she could have let it run wild in the garden in Buckingham Palace.
Why not?
And then through the wall and out into Green Park.
Am I right in thinking, I think the Cameroonian football team are called the Indomitable Elephants.
I think you might be right.
Yeah.
Or are they the Indomitable Eagles?
No, the Eagles is Nigeria. But I'm sure it's one of the big sort of footballing nations in Africa. It's called the Indomitable Elephants, which is just a great name. It is a great name, and you can always say about them kind of like great control for a big man. And I just like the idea of an elephant like trapping a football under its paw foot.
Hoof.
Have you ever tried to shoo an elephant? They get very angry if you hammer nails into them.
Cameroon are called the Indomitable Lions.
Oh, apparently. Well, yeah. Who are the elephants then?
Don't.
I hope it's not the Ivory Coast.
It's the Ivory Coast.
No!
Their nickname is Les Elephants.
That is so awful.
Very good. You knew a fact you didn't even know.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's sad. That feels like the motto for this podcast, doesn't it? Other presidential gifts. In 2011, when the Obamas visited Australia's Northern Territory, President Obama was given crocodile insurance worth $50,000 just in case one of them attacked either him or Michelle. And Obama, being the suave operator that he is, he said, "I have to admit, when we reformed healthcare in America, crocodile insurance is one thing we left out." And my favourite presidential gift, though, is in 2006, the Bulgarian president, Georgi Pervanov, not a great name, decided to give George W. Bush a puppy. And the puppy was called Balkan of Gorana Dragunov. Because for some reason, he decided to name the puppy after what sounded like Vlad the Impaler's best man.
And give it a name that George W. Bush probably wouldn't remember.
Yes. As Rachel has said, obviously this puppy was valued at $430, so had to be stored in the National Archives. No, it wasn't.
No.
What George Bush did is he bought it from the government and then gave it to a family friend in Maryland.
Yeah, some presidents do that if there's a particularly sentimental gift they can buy.
Yeah. The other gift that the Bulgarian leader gave him, and this is toadying as hell, he gave him a book in Bulgarian entitled The Leadership Genius of George W. Bush. One other gift, and this is mad, in the 1980s when the Iran-Iraq war kicked off, Iraq was backed by the United States because Iran was seen as the aggressor. I believe Iraq had more oil, and so the United States was very pally with one Saddam Hussein. Mm. And Donald Rumsfeld, as an envoy to the Middle East, went out there, had many conversations with Saddam Hussein to create closer ties between them. And there's even footage of them, you know, shaking hands. Some of the gifts that he bought Saddam Hussein were weird, including golden cowboy boots and what looked like a spiked hammer. Now, knowing at the time that Saddam was well into his torture, that is quite a pointed gift. But Saddam's present was way beyond that. he wanted to create tension between America and Syria and maybe even get American support for a potential Iraqi invasion of Syria.
He tried to give him a present of Syria.
No, he gave him a video, and on the video there is a black and white film containing footages of female Syrian soldiers biting the heads off live snakes and young male soldiers stabbing a dog to death.
Oh.
And apparently they did that under the approval of the then Syrian dictator Hafez al-Assad. And it was meant to be showing the brutality of the Syrian regime, which it did.
Wow.
But like, here's a video of some real medieval torture.
But he gave him that as a present rather than like in a presentation on the subject.
Sometimes you need to think about whether something is actually the present or whether you give it to them as well in a different way.
Yeah,
like, this is a present, this is research.
It certainly puts Gordon Brown's present of a DVD box set to Barack Obama into sharp relief.
No, yes. It was the other way round.
Oh, God, it was the other way round, right.
Obama gave Brown 25 American classic DVDs, which Gordon Brown couldn't play because of geographic restrictions on the DVDs at the time.
Such a terrible gift, isn't it?
It is a terrible gift. And I thought Barack Obama was going to be super smooth moves about this and like give him something really good, but no.
I love it, though.
And that Trump hasn't, as far as we know, come back and gone, oh, here's the DVD player so you can play these prime ministerial DVDs.
Well,
we
no, it's
still
a Trump,
unwatched.
It's a Trump DVD player.
Yes.
So
it's a Betamax.
Yeah. Some royal gifts. I didn't look too much at royal gifts, but my favourite one is the Republic of Vanuatu, and part of that there's the island of Tanna, which we've spoken about before, because that's the one that has the cargo cult that worships Prince Philip.
Yes.
And they see him as, they see him as a deity. And so there's a, if you go to that island, there are framed pictures and union flags and newspaper clippings celebrating him. And they've exchanged many gifts to him before, including a ceremonial club to kill pigs.
Yes.
Which you know that he's used.
He definitely treasures
definitely.
That one. Yeah,
yeah, he's used that on servants. But in 2009, when their chief, Jack Naiva, died, he sent them a letter giving condolences, which is quite sweet of him, I guess. And a year later, in 2010, they sent him as a gift a straw penis sheath. Which I presume is ceremonial. I don't know if it's practical. It does. I mean, something made out of straw is not really going to stop sperm swimming through.
I really enjoy that, though, because sheath, the Latin for sheath is vagina.
Oh, it's, what is it? Vagina means sheath.
It means literally like scabbard, where you put your sword. So, it's quite appropriate.
Also, presumably, the point of a straw penis sheath is that you can make it look a lot bigger than the thing. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm just assuming.
No, it's what happens is that the his sperm, they form a cult, and then they pick one sperm, they put it inside the straw sheath, and then they burn it as part of
a... So send a single sperm to Tanner once a year.
Yeah. the straw, by the way...
In a Tupperware, we don't know.
Yeah.
Straw penis sheath, by the way, could be added to the rain alongside dildo nubbins.
Yes, it could. Horrible. Horrible, horrible, horrible. I've got one more thing to talk about before I give you my suggestion. Napoleon II, who is the son of Napoleon Bonaparte, had a fairly short and undistinguished life. He only lived for 21 years and he died of tuberculosis, was buried in Austria, and was pretty much forgotten about for about a century. Until the year 1940, when Hitler invaded Western Europe, and obviously by 1940 he'd taken over France. The north was controlled by the Germans, the south was the puppet Vichy regime led by Philippe Pétain, and Hitler wanted to secure his authority in that area, so he thought, how can I gain the support of France? And he hatched a plan to repatriate Napoleon II's ashes from Vienna to Paris.
What a shit present.
Yeah.
Not even Napoleon.
Yeah, not even the right Napoleon. Well, he couldn't do that because Napoleon died in Elba, but his ashes were returned in 1840.
Yeah.
But the ashes turned up at midnight in Paris, guarded by German soldiers, and neither Hitler nor Pétain were there.
Oh, wow.
So basically, it was just a shit Hermes delivery.
That's so bad.
Yeah. But my suggestion...
It's like Britain going, I know you want the Elgin Marbles back, Greece, but here's some Brighton rock.
Yeah.
They've probably done that several times.
Trying to get away with it. They've written Athens through the middle of it.
My suggestion for the world's worst gift is a chap called James Allen, who was a notorious highwayman in the 1830s. And he worked in Massachusetts, robbing and killing people.
I like that you call it, he worked in Massachusetts.
It's a job. Just because he's part of the criminal economy doesn't mean that he's not working hard from 9 to 5, as Dolly Parton would approve. Eventually, he was apprehended and then hanged by a chap called John Fenno Jr. And Alan respected good craftsmanship, and he respected the man who had caught and hung him. So in his will, he decided to give him a gift, the gift was... basically his own biography, his life story and confession that was written out and then bound in his own skin.
Oof.
And he even declared himself to be the master of his own skin, and he was to the very, very end.
That's creepy.
And so
that's super creepy.
Gift was passed on from generation to generation through Fenno's family until eventually it was donated to the Boston Library, where it is described as having a slightly bumpy texture, like soft sandpaper. And I just find that, I really like the sense of fair play in it. It's kind of like, well done, you got me. Have my life story with a little bit of me as well.
What's the opposite of a page turner?
Yeah.
Well, I have looked at good housekeeping for ideas.
Okay.
Of what the worst possible gifts are. And Good Housekeeping had an article about the 31 gifts you should never, ever give.
Great.
So that's where I started. Number one on the list was exercise gear, obviously.
Because it seems like a dig.
There's also on the list also is number 7, DVDs, Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Take note. There's also number 9, anything too big, which made me... think of the Statue of Liberty.
Yes.
Which was a gift from the French to America in 1886.
Have you seen any of the early designs of the Statue of Liberty? There are loads of different versions of it, and like where the torch is going to be, and like different plinths and different models. It was really interesting watching. I was there a couple of years ago, and looking at the what it could have been, and then eventually what they went with is really interesting. They put a lot of thought into it I suppose when it's such a prominent present, you probably should.
It's like buying someone a statue for their garden or something. It's like you're kind of telling them that this is something they're going to display as if it's their taste.
That's true.
And I always think, like, don't buy things for people's homes because they might not like them, and then it's awkward to get rid of. I mean, the Americans, you know, they might have been like, well, this is awkward. How do we get rid of this 90-meter-high copper statue?
I feel like the Trump administration is in the midst of the regifting process of the Statue of Liberty at the moment.
Exactly, exactly. And the other thing that made me kind of stop and think when I was looking at this is there a delegation of military types in America who are, like... there to investigate massive statues which are given to their nation by other countries, just in case it's like the Trojan horse. And there were, you know, 1,000 French troops inside ready to break out and
what
take
a
over.
Great twist that would have been.
You've got to check. You have got to check.
Yeah.
Even if it's a silly idea.
My husband, when he gets little small gift wrap presents, he always picks them up and turns them upside down in case there's a moo box inside them.
That's amazing.
And he told me he used to do it all the time until eventually I bought him a moo box as a present.
Aww. Did he turn it upside down?
Yeah, he did. He
good,
did.
Good.
Yeah.
Everything should have a moo box in it.
I'm also pretty sure that's probably not what they're called, but I'm hoping everybody knows what I mean when I say a moo box.
I think so.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not my suggestion. That's just some things that I was looking at in search of my suggestion. And my actual suggestion is based on number 2 in the Good Housekeeping Gifts You Should Never Ever Give guide, which is pets.
Ah.
So we've already discussed that the Queen got given an elephant. I think China has also gifted America a couple of pandas.
Yeah,
but
the best
and therefore worst present that has ever been given was given to France by the nation of Mali in 2013 for helping them to liberate the country from some marauding Al-Qaeda fighters.
Oh, God, I forgot that.
Coming south
happened.
Through the country, and France sent some troops to get rid of them. And Mali, to say thank you, gave... President Francois Hollande a camel.
What I really wanted is for them to have given him a DVD of the film Marley and Me.
Anyway, so
Bactrian or Dromedary?
Not sure, actually.
Okay, one hump or two?
Don't know. Thicker. How many humps?
Look, is like, is this man coming on to me?
Let's have a look. Mali, Camel, France.
Was it one hump or two? Anyway, while you're looking that up, I'll just explain what happened. So Hollande obviously had a problem because how was he going to get this camel back to France? So what he eventually did...
Because at customs in France, there's an eye of the needle that you have to go through.
Exactly. So he gave it to a family in Timbuktu to look after for him.
Right.
Now, I then found an article related to this. And the headline of the article was, Malian authorities will give French President François Hollande another camel after the one they gave him in thanks for helping repel Islamist rebels was killed and eaten in a stew.
No!
Oh, but I have to tell you, camel, I believe, is pretty tasty, pretty succulent.
Well, so they couldn't help themselves, right? So
yeah.
They just had to eat it because...
couldn't help themselves. And they're just looking at this camel, licking their lips, going, oh.
The person I feel really sorry for is the defence minister at the time, whose name was Jean-Yves Le Drian, who was tasked with giving Hollande regular updates on the camel's status. And presumably had to break the news that the thing had been slaughtered.
Did he have to continue giving updates after it had been eaten as well? It's in the lower intestine now.
A casserole. Well, yeah, hopefully not all the way through. Anyway, so what happened after that was, in this news article, there's a quote from a spokesman from Mali, which says, as soon as we heard this, we quickly replaced it with a bigger and better looking camel. Said the official, who asked not to be named because he was not authorised to speak to the media.
They do have camel beauty contests in certain countries.
Eyelashes.
Eyelashes, like the shape of the hump, like the neatness of the
number of
and
humps.
Stuff of that, how it walks.
Also, I like the idea of camel beauty contests as being like the Saharan equivalent of a knobbly knees contest.
Yeah, a knobbly back contest. So, did he get to keep the replacement one?
Well, so, the Malian spokesperson went on to say, we are ashamed it was a present that did not deserve this fate. And he also said, we're sending this one straight to Paris.
Great.
So that camel presumably got, like, airlifted to Paris.
In a zoo.
And then, I'm not sure what happened to it after that.
Knowing Hollande, he probably had an affair with it, to be honest.
Probably. Well, he did say when he got the first camel that he was going to use it to get around Paris, which was
Wasn't there that ridiculous photo of coming out of his mistress's house and then riding like a tiny scooter with a helmet on while he was like wearing his suit he'd been wearing the night before back to the Elysee Palace? I would love him riding down Champs-Élysées in the back of a camel.
That would distract attention very much from where he'd come from, wouldn't it? Like, nobody would be asking that question.
Forget about the booty call. Yeah. What the fuck are you riding?
It's a brilliant way to get out of trouble.
Yes. It's a real, like, what's that thing? The dead cat thing. Don't talk about it, by talking about it. That's so good.
Yeah, you know, it's a strategy that Trump and Boris Johnson have aims to use, that it throw a dead cat on the table. So if you have been involved or accused of bad behaviour, then you do something ridiculous, that is the dead cat in the conversation. Someone's going, oh, look at that dead cat, rather than talking about, I don't know, giving one of your age/ex-girlfriends access to all sorts of government goodies.
We could call it the stewed camel strategy. Yeah. A gift in Germany's not that great. Mm-hmm. Or in Sweden.
Go on.
Because gift means poison in Swedish and in German.
Wow! Yeah. Nice work.
I found this on a BBC webpage from 2011. There was sort of a forum on language. And one guy called Josh posted this. One year when my German teacher, Herr McCarley, was living in Germany, he once opened the door to a very nervous-looking postman. The postman very slowly and carefully handed to Herr McCarley a package. His parents had sent him a Christmas present and did not want him to open it early, so they wrote gift many times on all sides of the package. What they did not know is that gift is German for poison, and the postman very shakily said, careful, poison, and left as soon as he could. gift, as I said, it means poison in Swedish as well. It also means married in Sweden. So suggesting that perhaps marriage is both a gift and a poison.
You're making that suggestion.
Yes, I don't. The Swedes, let me be very clear, the Swedes are making that suggestion. I read about wedding gifts, traditional wedding gifts as well.
Mm-hmm.
The suggestion of the practice of giving, like the silver and the gold wedding anniversary, for example, started in medieval Germany when a wife would be given a silver wreath after 25 years of marriage and a gold one when they reached 50. And naturally enough, it was capitalism that gave us the individual year gifts. In 1937, the American National Retail Jewelers Association created the expanded gift list, where there's a gift for every year up to 25 years of marriage and then one for every 5 years after that. Presumably to drum up business for themselves. So do you know some of the early, like the silver and gold in 25 and 50?
Yeah.
Do you know any of the other lower numbers?
So there's it's paper, tin. No, tin's quite far on. Paper, wood. I know that the leather anniversary is quite early on.
Leather's 3, yeah.
Yeah, so me and my wife had a large BDSM evening on that anniversary.
Nice.
Yeah, the first 5 on the traditional UK list are cotton, then paper, then leather, then linen, which I've just had, and wood is the 5th year one. So it takes you 5 years to get wood. That's courtesy of Peers Encyclopedia. There's a modern gift list as well.
I tried to skirt over it, but it turns out that Rachel had the filthy sense of humour on that one.
There's a modern gift list as well, created by the Chicago Public Library. That includes things like the clock, wedding anniversary, china, crystal. Fourth one I really like, the electrical appliances anniversary.
Wow. Yeah.
I also like that the traditional list has sugar and salt as the 6th and 8th years on the list. The modern one also has things like pen and pencil sets. That's your 7th anniversary. 9th is leather goods. 15th anniversary is watches. 17th is furniture. So you go from like getting a watch to like a chaise longue. And 24th is musical instruments. So you can have that to look forward to down the line.
I mean, there comes a point where it's better just to call it a day rather than have to gift each other tambourines the next year. Just let's knock this on the head now.
Silver gets a lot of look-ins because obviously silver is 25th, but also silverware is the 5th in some lists. Silver hollowware is the 16th on one list, and silver plate and diamond obviously gets lots of look-ins as well. Your diamond jewellery anniversaries are 10th, but also diamond is the 30th, 60th, 75th and 80th anniversary as well.
80th anniversary, so that's people who are probably like pushing 100 if you get to that.
You can go higher. The traditional UK list has actually for your 80th anniversary you should get oak, 85th, wine and 90th, stone.
That is in horrible taste.
Even worse is the modern list goes further and more on the nose. The 90th anniversary of the modern list is engraved marble or granite.
Wow.
Yeah, preparing. Oh, so I read about the. Have you been to? Have either you been to New York?
I have not.
And Fifth Avenue, obviously. Very famous street. Lots of the big flagship shops are on Fifth Avenue, including Cartier's big flagship. It's beautiful, like mansion, 6 stories tall. And they were given this in 1917 by a New York banker called Morton Plank. He wanted a $1 million pearl necklace from them, and he gifted his New York Fifth Avenue mansion to them in exchange for this necklace, which he was giving as a gift to his wife. A few years later, cultured pearls were invented, which basically caused the price of pearls to crash. necklace was sold for just $150,000 after her death in 1956. The Plank Mansion has served as Cartier's New York flagship for almost a century, and it's probably worth hundreds of millions of dollars nowadays, making it maybe one of the most expensive barters ever.
Yeah.
Cartier also have a hand in this story. In 1969, there was a big bidding war for the Cartier diamond, which people like Aristotle at Nassus, Harry Winston, Cartier themselves, the Sultan of Brunei and Richard Burton were all bidding to try and buy. It was eventually bought by Robert Kenmore, who was the CEO at Cartier. And 24 hours later, Richard Burton offered to buy it from them for $1.1 million. He ran to a phone box and called them. $1.1 million is about €1 billion in modern
money.
Wow. Yeah. To give it to Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor then had them make it up into a necklace, adding another $80,000 onto the price tag. And because she wanted to cover a scar from a tracheotomy. And she sold the piece in 1978 and gifted the money to an African medical charity. Quite nice of her.
That's nice.
Yeah. I read about gift wrapping as well. First documented in ancient China. Yeah. They ain't. No. So invented papers invented about the 2nd century BC.
Ancient China invented most things.
Yeah, it? Yeah. They probably invented, you know, the gift receipt as well. they used to wrap monetary gifts in a paper envelope known as a qi pao. And they'd be distributed to Chinese government officials. So you were meant to give gifts of money back then. They used things like rice straw and bamboo fibre to make those particular paper. The Victorians used very thick paper as well, and tissue paper. But in 1917, sort of the modern trend for gift wrapping, which the industry is now worth about $3 billion a year in America alone. A stationery store in downtown Kansas City, two men called Raleigh and Joyce Hall, were selling greeting cards and gifts, and they used red and green and white tissue paper for wrapping the things. And one day they ran out of the tissue paper, so Raleigh came across some envelope liners that they used instead. They're basically, you put them inside your envelope to make a slight tint of colour shine through. If it was a white envelope and you had a red thing inside, a sort of slightly pinky look. And so he took these envelope liners, put them next to the cash register, priced them at 10 cents a piece, and they had nice geometric shapes and patterns and floral design. They weren't plain, they had Christmas motifs and things, and so people went crazy for them. They sold out of them, and they continued to do that year on year. By 1919, they started designing and manufacturing their own, and the Hall brothers went on to create Hallmark. And they added ribbons onto the things in the 1930s. They had a promotional film in 1958 called The Art of Gift Wrapping, featuring a gift wrap stylist. And in the 50s and 60s, they would have women travelling around the country demonstrating gift wrapping techniques as well. So it was a big, big money for them. I looked at medieval Valentine's gifts.
The mind buckles.
According to The Art of Courtly Love, 12th century book by Andreas Capellanus, it suggested you buy your partner a wash basin, which is probably up there with gym equipment in terms of no-nos.
Yeah, that's quite passive aggressive.
Yeah, it's rather than buying furniture, get right to the root of the problem.
Yeah.
Rather than buying perfume, get right to the root of the problem. He also suggests, someone else suggested you personalise your beloved clothes. Marie de France was a...
Is that while they're wearing them? You just kind of beetle up to your, actually, loved one and just like put a little monogram on there.
By the sound of it, probably. This is from the poetry and tales of Marie de France, who was fascinating and someone I want to read more about. She was a pioneer of the French lay. So she as well, writing in the 12th century. She writes about marriage as being like a prison a lot of the time, which was very sort of subversive for the era.
Yeah.
And she wrote about adding fasteners only you know how to undone to people's clothing, basically so you can create your own chastity belt and keep your lover.
So basically she invented the bra strap.
Yes.
No, they all have 19 clasps on.
Yeah. I love that. Or like finally someone gets down to a bodice and it's just got a little sort of like a code on it that you've got to get in. Fingerprint, then an eye.
A portcullis to lift at the end. So what else? Oh, yeah, another one from the 12th century romance of Cliget by Chrétien de Troyes. He suggested that you should upcycle your friend's shirts, your lover's shirts, by sewing strands of your own hair into it. And I really like this one. A troubadour called Chastelain de Coucy apparently literally gave his own heart to his lover. So she gave him braids of her hair, and then he went off into battle, and he was mortally wounded in battle. And so he instructed a servant to cut out his own heart and send it back to her along with the braids of hair to remember him by. Her husband, yes, she was married, her husband intercepted this gift, realised what it was, and had it cooked and fed to her instead, according to a 13th century biography of de Coucy.
That's quite grim, isn't it?
Yeah, it's up there with Van Gogh in his ear, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But I probably think more fatal.
Giving actual bits of your body to people is quite a strange...
Yeah.
Quite a strange gifting technique.
Certainly
I don't
uninvited.
Know whether we don't do that anymore, do we, traditionally?
Even the locks of hair thing isn't really a thing anymore. That seemed like to be the most, like, acceptable version of that.
Yeah, because if I got a lock of hair in the post from someone who thought they were in love with me, I'd be like, why have you cleared out your bathroom plug and sent the remnants to me? May as well go, oh, I love you, my darling, I send you my belly button fluff as a symbol of my love.
So Anne Lister, who was the first modern lesbian, used to cut bits of pubic hair off her lovers and keep them in lockets.
Of her lovers?
Yeah.
And she Oh, because obviously if he was cutting them off other people's
imagine
lovers.
Imagine having a breakup conversation with somebody. They just go, excuse me, bit of admin. I need some of your pubes for my locket.
You really need to do it. That's hard then, because you need to chop it early on in case the breakup happens quite quickly. But it's a really awkward conversation to have early on in a relationship.
What I mean. So if, you know, if it never gets to the point where it's come up naturally in conversation,
yes,
then if you break up, you've got to raise the issue of that you're going to be missing a vital locket if they don't. And that's not, I don't know about you, but that's not the point at which I want someone to be raising that sort of thing. Couldn't we have discussed this earlier? So it's quite strange. And she
how many lockets does she have?
I'm not sure exactly. Also, what happened to them? That's the real question.
That's the real question, yes.
Yeah.
Some very, very specific collector has them somewhere.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. She writes in her diaries about how whether she cut the piece of hair herself or whether her lover cut it for her stuff like that.
This is Gentleman Jack.
Yeah.
Wow, very good.
Mm.
I read a little bit more about more presents to heads of state because it's a very fertile area.
Really is.
You mentioned George Bush being given a puppy. He was also given some roller skates and a taxidermy lion and leopard by the president of Tanzania.
Oh, wow.
So sitting on the moose Antler throne with your taxidermy lion and leopard on one side and the other in the Oval Office. However, I think that's probably better than the leader of Indonesia decided that George Bush Sr. Should be given a giant venomous Komodo dragon in 1990 called Naga. He regifted it to Cincinnati Zoo, where it lived until 2004 and fathered 32 Komodo dragon babies as well.
Is that above average?
I don't know, but it's a lot. That's 14 years. It's a lot of babies. That's more than two a year.
This is what you have to think about when you gift somebody something.
It's a gift that really does keep on giving.
Exactly. It's like, am I starting a Komodo dragon legacy gift? Is it going to be a hell of a lot of cleaning out of cages to be done?
Yeah. Alternatively, some really tasty exotic breakfasts from time to time.
Yeah, delicious.
And gifts to the Queen. We mentioned her elephant from Cameroon. She was also given two black beavers from Canada, two giant turtles from the Seychelles, a canary from Germany. What else you get? President Pompidou of France in 1972 gave her a grasshopper, not an actual grasshopper, but a giant metal grasshopper wine cooler.
You see, what? You can't stick that on eBay, can you? Really?
Yeah.
It's very awkward.
You'd know who owned it. She got a pair of sloths from Brazil in 1968. When she visited Ireland recently, she was given some horse sperm.
how was that delivered?
They cut out the middleman. a horse owner called Christina Patino owns a stallion called Big Bad Bob, which is standing at a horse stud in Ireland. And she offered to let the Queen send one of the royal mares to visit Big Bad Bob. Would normally command a fee of about £5,000 for one shot, if you like. What else?
That's a weird gift to offer to sort of pimp your horse to somebody, isn't it?
Definitely you want to put it in the right terms. You want to say...
How do you broach that conversation?
You definitely don't say, do you want some horse spunk?
It wasn't even that convenient, though, was it?
No.
It was more like you're going to have to get the horse to come here.
Yeah. She was given a hockey puck by Canada, which was the hockey puck used by Morris the Rocket Richard to score his 325th goal for the Montreal Canadiens Hockey Club. Now, the Queen, as we all know, is a very keen hockey fan.
Yeah.
Imagine being given this. Presumably, there are people in the world who would love to own that hockey puck, like big hockey fans. And you give it to this octogenarian, monarch who's probably never even seen an ice hockey rink from the inside. She's only been outside of cutting the ribbon.
I imagine she probably looked at it and went, oh, this looks like a delicious biscuit.
Yeah. One of Charles's.
Well, she's put it under a door somewhere in Buckingham Palace and it's just keeping a draft in.
Yeah,
just entertaining the corgis. Maybe I imagine they've got a lake in the back garden of Buckingham Palace. When it ices over, she dresses up the corgis like NHL players and sends them out there.
We mentioned Vanuatu. When she visited Fiji, a local chiefs present her with a tabua or a whale tooth, which are very apparently prized in Fijian society. Mm-hmm. And she was given a Maori canoe by the New Zealand government once as well. But maybe my favourite one is that some of the presents she got when she and Philip got married. They were given 1,700 wedding presents, which included several hundred nylon stockings. Because they'd been, because it was just after the war, and nine stockings had been rationed, so it was quite a luxury item, I suppose. And they were given a box of apples, 2 dozen handbags, 12 bottles of sloe gin, and Australia sent her 500 cases of pineapple
in tins.
In tins.
I mean, if this were the 19th century, then pineapple was pound for pound worth more than gold.
Yeah,
so actual
yeah.
pineapples would have been a remarkable gift, but tinned pineapple.
500 of them.
It's
but
like
there wasn't a lot around in 1947.
Fair.
So,
fair.
From Australia.
Yeah.
I would say the servants of Buckingham Palace ate a lot of pineapple that year. but my world's worst gift is going to come from, we've mentioned him already, it's from Hitler and the Nazis. I did not know this, and we haven't yet done World's Worst Christmas. I think we're going to do it at some point.
Mm.
The Nazis
tried... dreaming of a World's Worst Christmas.
You joke, Ben.
What, they sent them the stuffed body of Bing Crosby?
The whitest of white Christmases.
How many white supremacy jokes are we going to try and crowbar into this week's episode?
I'm sad to say they are oddly topical, which is not something I thought I'd be saying in 2019.
No.
I did not realise the Nazis tried to completely rebrand Christmas.
Well, yes, of course, they changed him to Father Claus. No, Santa Claus.
Hitler being very anti-Christian and anti-clerical... Mm-hmm. was very hot on reconnecting with the pagan aspect of Christmas.
So did all the snowflakes and the decorations just look like swastikas?
Genuinely, yes.
Oh, God!
Some Christmas trees replaced the star on top of the tree with swastikas.
No, that can't be true!
Genuinely, yes. And so, certainly less Star of David-y looking starbursts. There was an article from 1937, a propaganda article called New Meanings for Inherited Customs in inverted commas, because Christmas was traditionally viewed as a holiday about theoretical peace for all humanity, an interpretation that should be rejected in favour of making it a holiday of actual domestic national peace. So more inward looking, you know, ridding Germany of unwanted outside forces type thing. In Germany, Christmas is called Weihnachten, so it doesn't have the Christ bit in it. But the Nazis preferred calling Christmas Rauhnacht, or the Rough Night, which already has a lovely hint of violence to it. They tried to rebrand Santa in a way. They sort of moved towards having Odin, the god, as calling him the Solstice Man.
I mean, I'm a little bit on board with that. I don't know about you. Having Odin Allfather be where we worship and celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. They moved the celebration of Christmas to the solstice, back rather than the celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ. They moved it back to the more Northern European, a much more Aryan celebration, long before Christianity comes to the country. Sort of celebrating the racially pure Northern European tribes and all of that. They rewrote songs. You joke about White Christmas, but they did rewrite the lyrics of things like of Silent Night, or wrote completely new songs as well. One called Exalted Night of the Clear Stars was a popular favourite. The lyrics of the new Silent Night apparently espoused...
Did it change to Silent Night of the Long Knives?
They did espouse the benefits of National Socialism, and they were rewritten by Alfred Rosenberg and Heinrich Himmler, you know, alongside Lennon and McCartney.
But they eventually fell out because they were credited as Rosenberg and Himmler, and Himmler was like, no, it's got to be the other way around.
Yeah.
There's a whole another episode for you here in World's Worst Songwriting Duos.
Oh, we've got that. No, we've done that already.
Yeah,
sorry, Daphne and Celeste, again.
They're going to get over. I think they might be overtaken by Rosenberg and Himmler.
They might be. And eventually they broke up because Himmler got a Japanese girlfriend.
Yeah. Not only that, but at the height of Nazi Christmas. It's a funny thing to say. They would replace the mention of the Saviour with calling him the Saviour Führer, so they tried to link Hitler into the whole thing as much as possible. They would put Nazi party figures in nativity scenes.
Oh my god, so instead of like the Christ the Redeemer statue in Sao Paulo, they would have him building the Christ the Führer statue.
Yeah,
with him.
Absolutely, with him pointing up rather than sideways. They had figures of blonde Marys and Jesuses.
Yeah.
The advent calendars you could buy were full of propaganda and military imagery. And my and toy catalogues had things like chocolate SS officers, tanks, planes, machine guns. It was all, again, feeding the Nazi propaganda machine. But I think the world's worst gift associated with this were probably the gifts that Himmler used to give to members of the SS. He would give them, I think, called a Uhlichter, which was a like an earthenware candle holder with decorations of pagan symbols on them. And they were made at the Alak subcamp at Dachau by prisoners.
Oh, no.
So they had concentration camp inmates making these gifts that he could then give to members of the SS. And so it's the crowning turd on top of the steaming pile of the Nazi Christmas. You'd be glad to know a lot of the songs that they wrote for those Christmas are now banned in Germany. But certainly, I think a Uhlichter, particularly the ones from the Alach, would constitute a world's worst gift in my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, that knocks my camel into a cocked hat.
It really does, especially if you're giving that as a gift for Hanukkah.
Our candidates this week for the world's worst gift are Ben's suggestion of the hidebound biography of James Allen, a Massachusetts highwayman, given to the man who captured and hanged him. Rachel's suggestion of Mali's eaten camel, eaten very appropriately.
Don't confuse this, it was not dressed in a three-piece suit.
The digested camel that Mali tried to give to France in 2013, and my suggestion of Himmler's gifts to his SS officers, the Uhlichter or candle holder. Mine is very sad and very horrible, but practical. It holds a candle. It's a perfectly functional candle holder. Ben, your suggestion is creepy AF.
Yep.
A perfectly functional biography.
Yep.
And an interesting coffee book table. Rachel, your suggestion got eaten.
Yeah.
Which was not the purpose it was designed for.
No.
And I think it's right in the bullseye of what we like in the show, which is weird presents, but also heroically failing to give the gift in the first place. The fact that they had to give it again and sort of fess up to the fact that, oh, that gift we gave you, we kind of broke it.
We've got you a bigger, better looking camel.
Yeah. Like Holland would have any idea. So I think I'm going to pick your Malian camel gift.
Wow, well done.
Fantastic.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's worst news of the week. And God, there's so much to choose from. There's really so much to choose from. But I'm going to go with a move coming from my very own beloved football club. Liverpool Football Club have failed in a move to trademark the word Liverpool.
Good.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy about that.
You'll be glad to know that the bid was rejected due to the geographical significance of the city. The fact that there's a city with that name probably overrules you. They insisted that all revenue... The club insisted that all revenue from the protected services and products using the word Liverpool would be channeled into reinvestment, namely on transfers in the stadium. But it sparked a degree of outrage, let it be said, within the supporters of the club. And the IPO decision was confirmed today, in fact, that they were not going to give them this particular trademark. Peter Moore, the club's executive officer, said it should be stressed that our application was put forward in good faith and with the sole aim of protecting and furthering the best interests of the club and its supporters. I would also like to take the opportunity to reiterate all our thanks to all those who engaged with us throughout this process, most notably independent traders and local football clubs, presumably people who were shouting them down at every possible opportunity. The Spirit of Shankly, a leading Liverpool supporters union, described the decision as a victory for common sense, and they said we should all be allowed to use the word freely however we see fit without fear of legal letters dropping through our door. Liverpool Football Club have enough legal remedies from their current trademarks to address any issues they have. Any more is unnecessary. So champions of Europe, Liverpool FC, without the little TM in the top corner. Before we go, Rachel, where can people find out more about you and your work and your shows and all of that stuff?
I think the best thing to do is to look up my comedy science podcast, which is called Level Up Human. It is a podcast which seeks to answer the question, how should we redesign the human body?
And very good. And we're all off to suggest that maybe the insertion of a dildo nubbins is the next level up that humans are looking for. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye.